Coming up on the program today, who are you and what have you done with Donald Trump's economic policies? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday. This one's the 13th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If you've noticed something different about President Trump the past couple of days, you're right. It's not just you. He has changed his mind, it seems, on some not insignificant points of economic policy. China, as we touched on yesterday at the end of the broadcast, now all of a sudden is not manipulating its currency anymore. Fed Chair Janet Yellen, whom candidate Trump accused of playing politics with interest rates, if you remember that, now is not so bad, it turns out. She is, quote, not toast when her term ends next year. He told the Wall Street Journal, not toast. That's an official presidential proclamation. So what is going on? Here's Mitchell Hartman from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
President Trump this week sounds friendlier to Fed Chair Janet Yellen, warmer about trade with China, more supportive of the Export-Import Bank. The president's economic positions are evolving pretty rapidly.
All presidents learn on the job.
That's Scott Clemens, chief investment strategist at Brown Brothers Harriman.
Once you're confronted with the reality of governing, you become a little bit more of a practicalist, a little bit more of a realist. I think there is a shift more towards, if you will, traditional Republican orthodoxy.
That's certainly what Cornell economist Eswar Prasad sees on the foreign policy front. Take China, which Trump now says he won't label a currency manipulator, but will work with to open markets while also trying to get China's help controlling North Korea.
We don't know what trade policy will look like next week. Certainly this week, the protectionist and nationalist forces have given some ground
to administration officials like U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin.
People who recognize that the U.S. economy does benefit from freer flows of both trade and financial capital.
There's no clear indication yet how these shifts might impact broader economic policy. And Scott Clemens cautions we shouldn't expect President Trump to suddenly go completely by the book. This week, he also tread where presidents rarely do, saying the U.S. dollar is too strong. And he's still pointing out when individual companies keep jobs here or ship them overseas. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Best part of that dollar thing, by the way, was that he told the Journal it was too strong because people have confidence in him. That is also a quote. All right, from macroeconomic policy changes to education policy changes in the Trump administration. This week, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos withdrew some Obama-era policies aimed at cleaning up the student loan servicing industry. If you're one of the 42 or so million people out there with federal student loans, you know what I'm talking about. Companies, for-profit companies or non, paid by the federal government to collect your payments and handle any problems with the loan. The name Navient might ring a bell. One of the last moves of the Obama Department of Education was to sue that company for bad practices. From the education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on that.
I asked Christine Lindstrom to sum up the problems she's seen with student loan servicing.
Wow.
Lindstrom is higher education program director at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. She says complaints range from poor customer service and misprocessed payments to borrowers being steered into more expensive repayment plans. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's recent lawsuit accuses the largest servicer, Navient, of failing borrowers at every stage of repayment, which the company denies.
We've been concerned with whether the treatment that borrowers get actually makes their problems worse.
The federal government is in the process of awarding new contracts to servicers. The Obama administration had directed federal student aid officials to consider past abuses when awarding those contracts and to include consumer protections. Persis Yu is with the National Consumer Law Center.
The rules, in my opinion, were very basic common sense, you know, rights that in almost any other industry borrowers have.
In a memo, Secretary DeVos said the reversal was meant to, quote, negate any impediment, ambiguity, or inconsistency. Financial aid expert Mark Kantrowitz with CapEx.com says overall complaints about student loan servicers are low compared to, say, credit cards or auto loans.
So it doesn't seem like there is a systemic problem in any kind of loan program. Borrowers do not love their lenders.
Still, he says the move signals the Trump administration may be less focused on protecting borrowers. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street kind of ran out of gas today amid a little bit of geopolitical uncertainty. Down all the way around, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been, shall we say, a very bad stretch for airlines. Delta canceling all those flights this past weekend, weather, it should be said. The United video, about which we need say no more. But all of that has overshadowed a proposal by the White House to privatize the air traffic control system. Taking air traffic control out of the hands of the FAA has been a priority for the airline industry for a good long while now. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington explains, government agencies that have been around for 60-some-odd years, they don't just go away.
1241 LA Tower, 5 miles in trail of it.
This is the sound of just a few of the 1,500 airplanes taking off and landing out of LAX in Los Angeles every day. As they travel across the country, the planes are guided using land-based radar, just as they've done for over a half century. Speaking at a CEO town hall last week, White House economic advisor Gary Cohn said this is all while other countries have upgraded to modern satellite GPS systems years ago.
Which is kind of insulting that we're the last to do air traffic control, not the first to do air traffic control. A country that has Silicon Valley and all of the technology entrepreneurs that we have, we're playing catch up. That's embarrassing for us.
Cohn says the president supports a push to take air traffic control out of the hands of the Federal Aviation Administration and give it to a nonprofit corporation. It's a move supported by both the airlines and the Air Traffic Controllers Union. Sharon Pinkerton directs policy at Airlines for America, a trade group representing the airline industry.
So when you have labor, industry, the White House, and a bipartisan group of members in Congress, you know, we believe the momentum is definitely on our side.
Pinkerton says flights between cities often follow inefficient zigzagging routes, which adds billions of dollars in fuel costs and travel time.
And this is despite the fact that we've got new planes, new technology. So something's happening with our air traffic control system that's causing that inefficiency.
Pinkerton says a satellite GPS system would allow more flights to fly closer together. And for more than a decade, the FAA has been working on a project called NextGen to do just that.
I'll be the first to acknowledge that we would all like to move faster.
Michael Huerta is the FAA administrator. Speaking at an aviation summit last month, he underscored that the FAA is within a few years of making the switch to GPS, and NextGen has already provided substantial value to the system.
The FAA can demonstrate that it has already delivered more than $2.7 billion in benefits under the NextGen Modernization Program, and we expect that number to climb to $160 billion by 2030.
Critics of privatization argue that separating air traffic control from the FAA would make it less accountable to the public. Selena Shalad is director of the Alliance for Aviation Across America, a nonprofit advocate for rural airports. Under a private model, she says, any board of directors risks becoming stacked in favor of the big airlines.
So depending on the whims and interests and decisions of that board, they could control everything from investments in particular facilities or infrastructure. They could also decide who pays what into the system.
Shalad says the president's plan to privatize the FAA would cut federal funding to smaller airports, which won't win much support from lawmakers in rural states. Republican Jerry Moran of Kansas is part of a vocal group of senators who oppose a breakup of the FAA. Speaking on the Senate floor, Moran said rural airports create jobs.
In communities across our state, we're able to have manufacturing and service industries that probably otherwise, in the absence of an airport, would have to be located in larger cities in Kansas or elsewhere.
Current FAA funding runs out in September, at which point reauthorization hearings in Congress will surely put privatization back on the runway. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
In Venezuela today, opponents of President Nicolas Maduro clashed again with government security forces. In the past couple of weeks, tens of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets to protest Maduro's government and, by extension, the absolutely dismal state of the Venezuelan economy. Daniel Gallas is the BBC's South American business correspondent. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
These riots have been going on now in Venezuela for weeks, at least. Is it the economy? Is it something else? What's going on?
Well, it's the economy a lot, but it's also politics too. You have a war going on between the Congress and the president. And on top of that, you're seeing the worst economic recession probably in the world. That's a country with 800% inflation. There are no goods in the shops. Purchasing power is down. There are four different exchange rates. So an economic mess, and institutions are not able to move around it.
How are people getting by then? I mean, I imagine you can't line up at stores for goods that aren't there. So what are people doing? Is it a barter economy now? Is it effectively all black market?
Well, people have the choice of going to a supermarket that's sponsored by the government. But the problem is that there is too much demand. So people just queue up for those products. The alternative is to go to the black market, which is literally the streets, the bachaqueros, they call, which are the people who buy these goods some either in the black market or in the official stores, and they sell it for a lot more expensive prices. That's a pretty bad situation in terms of food and more seriously, medication for hospitals. So it's a humanitarian disaster as well.
I saw on the wire services as I was coming into the studio to speak with you that for the first time, the extremely poor in Venezuela, the people who live in the slums of Caracas and the big cities, have turned against the government now. They've come out protesting the government, which they had previously supported in the past.
Yes, we've seen a change in allegiance. A lot more people today are blaming Maduro. Maduro, for a while, he had sort of a good popularity with people because he was seen as the successor to Chavez. Chavez ruled Venezuela in very different times when the barrel of oil, which is sort of the lifeline of the Venezuelan economy, was very high globally. And that actually sponsored a lot of change in people's lives. So people loved Chavez, but that did not sustain itself. The problem is that Venezuelans have been protesting for the past 2 years, but that has done very little to change things at the top.
Talk to me for a second about what could change things then. I imagine thing number one on that list is a sharp increase in the price of oil.
Sharp increase in the price of oil would change the situation on the ground. Another thing that hasn't worked and what people put a lot of hope is international mediation, but probably elections are what could trigger a response. We don't know exactly how Maduro would respond, though, in case he does lose the election.
And the election is next year, right? And does he hold on till then, do you think?
Maduro has managed to sort of stop all the referendums, but the way the economy has been for such a long period, it's hard to see him actually holding on to power for this long.
Daniel Gallas, the BBC's business correspondent in South America. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up.
Demand is always good. Oversupply is bad.
In beer as in life. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 138 points today, about 0.6%, finished at 20,453. The NASDAQ fell 31 points, about 0.5%, 5805. The S&P 500 down 15.6 tenths percent, 23.28. Markets close tomorrow, Good Friday also. We end the market week today. And it is down. The Dow off 1% for the past 4 days. The S&P 500 off 1.1%. The NASDAQ gave up 1.2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus fell, landed at 2.23%. Once again, what is Janet Yellen thinking? You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Depending on where you're coming from, the election last November either feels like forever ago or like it just happened. Be that partisanship as it may, though, or really, because of it. The money's already flowing into special congressional elections, the 4th District of Kansas earlier this week, and next Tuesday, the Georgia 6th in the suburbs of Atlanta, a seat that until he became the Secretary of Health and Human Services was held by Republican Tom Price. Democrats think they have a chance now, though, but as WABE's Johnny Kaufman reports, both sides are testing the limits of what outside money might do for him.
Like a lot of Democratic voters, David Levinson had a tough morning after the presidential election.
I actually cried. I've never cried at the loss of an election.
Levinson lives in Brooklyn, New York, but he read about Georgia Democrat John Ossoff on Facebook. He's donated about $60 to Ossoff's campaign so far and plans to keep giving right up to the election. Ossoff is a 30-year-old former congressional staffer and the top Democrat in the special election here. According to the latest federal filings, Ossoff has raised more than $8 million. That's one of the biggest hauls for any House candidate ever. Much of it has come from out-of-state donors like Levinson. Steve Covert is a Georgia Republican who attended a recent debate between the GOP candidates. He does not like all the outside money coming in.
You know, being supported by, you know, the money from California, New York, and God knows where else. You know, I mean, he's not just a Democrat. I think he's pretty extremely on the left. And, you know, that offends a lot of our sensibilities around here, too, you know.
This has been a Republican district since the 80s. But last year, Trump barely won it. Democrats say that gives them a chance. But Covert says seeing the outside money come in is inspiring him and his Republican neighbors.
Yes, we're motivated. Hope we can motivate some that aren't quite so motivated between now and next Tuesday.
There are 11 Republican candidates in the race and 5 Democrats. If one of them from either party gets more than 50%, they'll win outright. Otherwise, there will be a runoff between the top 2 contenders. National GOP groups have sent in at least $4 million of their own to oppose Ossoff. And they're using that outside money to highlight, well, all the outside money that's come to Ossoff's campaign. One ad from the Republican-aligned Congressional Leadership Fund ties the Democrat to House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
The truth is, Nancy Pelosi's friends are bankrolling Ossoff's campaign because Ossoff will rubber stamp her liberal agenda.
But money isn't the only thing that's coming to Ossoff from outside the district. Volunteers like Chris Michonis, a student in Virginia, have traveled here from around the country. Ossoff's campaign paid for Michonis' hotel and bus ride.
It was probably about a 12 or 13-hour ride.
Michonis says the bus got in about 4:30 in the morning. A few hours later, he was out in the sun knocking on doors for Ossoff. Michonis looks tired as he takes a break in an air-conditioned field office, but he says it was all worth it.
There's a wave of activism and energy that's about to hit them in midterms and all the elections to come.
Local volunteers are out knocking on doors for Republicans here, too. But GOP leader Jason Shepherd is worried the party isn't as energized as Democrats like Michonis. Shepherd says Republicans need to act like they're the underdogs, even if they're not.
You know, if you run like you're 10 points behind, then even in a seat like this, you're probably going to be more than 10 points ahead at the end of the day.
The money shows both Republicans and Democrats think this race is competitive. In Atlanta, I'm Johnny Kaufman for Marketplace.
This might just be me, but I happen to think it's healthy every once in a while to take a break from everything going on in the world today, which is how last week I wound up at a brewery in Inglewood, California, hard by LAX, called Three Weavers. It's a craft brewery for sure. Independent, apparently, is the phrase du jour. It's one of those places where you can sit and sip a beer with a straight shot view of the fermentation tanks. And lest you think this is just me doing a beer story, I mean, it is, but it's also about a small business, its place in the local economy, and how its founders are planning to grow that business. But I did start by asking brewmaster Alexander Knoll that most logical of questions one might ask at a brewery. What's your favorite kind of beer?
I like IPAs. Although, okay,
oh, yes.
Honestly,
there's a win. All right, we're good. This interview's over.
It's a hard question to ask a brewer. My taste changes. I pretty much want to drink a Pilsner all the time.
Yeah. Do you
So you know how like movie directors and producers and stuff will go sit in the back of a theater and watch their film with a blind audience?
Yeah.
Do you do that ever?
Oh, yeah.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
You just go lurk and watch people drink your beer?
I wouldn't say lurk. That seems like a really creepy way to put things. But yeah, in some ways I do. I will lurk at bars occasionally. I know a lot of accounts that may not know me,
right,
and they give you just completely unadulterated feedback, and it's great. Because a lot of times,
great or
most people don't know that I'm the brewer. Oh, people can say bad things about the beer. There's nothing crazy, and a lot of it comes down to personal taste. So,
yeah.
I mean, taste is so subjective that that's great. I'm sorry if someone doesn't like the beer, but there's like 20 other people who love it. So,
yeah. How did you wind up doing this?
Brewing in general?
Yeah.
Because
you're not your average brewer, shall we say.
I've been working on my beard for a while, but I'm having a hard time growing it in. I studied it in college, as an elective in my senior year. So I kind of fell for the art, the science, the whole, the activity.
I don't want to hit this too hard, but it and I won't after this. But when you go to L.A. brewer conventions or national or global brewer conventions, you're probably the only woman in the room, real close to it.
That's changing.
Is it?
Yeah. Over the course of the time that I've been in this industry, which is about 10 years now, it looked different earlier than it does now. There are far more women. We're still a vast minority of like the crowd in the room, but it grows all the time. Yeah.
Show me around, would you?
Yeah.
All right, good. Hi, I'm Kai.
Hi, Lynn
nice
Weaver.
Nice to see you. Introduce yourself. Tell me who
My
you
name
are.
Is Lynn Weaver. I am the founder and CEO of Three Weavers Brewing Company.
Why did you start this company?
I was at home at that point in time with my three daughters, who are the Three Weavers, and I was brewing at home at that point in time. So when we actually started going down the road of opening up a brewery, I realized that my strengths lay much more on the business aspect than brewing. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I get that you're still early on in your business's life, and maybe the answer to this is I don't know yet, but when did you know you were going to make it?
I always knew I was going to make it. I plan
funny,
out.
Because Alex just snorted over there, and she kind of went, huh.
She snorted because she's seen my projections, that's why.
So, well, what are the projections? Tell me.
We constantly update them within every 3 months because our growth has been going much faster than we anticipated, so I'm having to adapt them, you know, on a quarterly basis.
How hard is it for you with a great growth profile, clearly, that you both believe in? How hard is it for you to restrain that growth?
Demand is always good.
Yeah.
Oversupply is bad, right? We just happen to be very lucky and also fortunate that we started in Los Angeles, in California. California is the sixth largest economy in the world. Los Angeles is the largest beer market in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about a bubble, but it's not. It's not like real estate where you have manipulations in interest rates and like the Fed's controlling in that manner, right? It's a natural progression of how an industry will like grow.
What is the end goal here? Do you guys want to get sold? I mean, Golden Road, as you know, got sold to AB InBev, right?
Just we're not on that path. It's become very much of a family, and I think that Lynn and I feel responsible for what's going on in our employees' lives. So it's a labor of love, and even retirement in the brewing industry doesn't mean that much. So I like to quote one of my former employers, John Martin of Drake's, and he says that his end game is a pine box. And I think that's very true for a lot of brewers, including ours.
I would like to buy some of your best IPAs, please. All right, what are we pouring here?
Okay. We're going to start with our flagship here.
All right. Flagship's always a good way to go.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Expatriate IPA.
Okay. It's pretty good, actually. Quite good. Truth be told, pictures, but sadly not samples. They're at home in my fridge at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, courtesy of our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood. On our tech show this morning, Molly mentioned Rachel Whetstone, head of communications at Uber, who left this week after a very rough start to the year. So herewith, from Ms. Wood, Whetstone's 2017 list of particulars.
Allegations of sexual harassment in the engineering department. Reports of a toxic culture of competition and disorganization. A boycott campaign. A public lecture from two high-profile investors. A video of CEO Travis Kalanick losing his cool at an actual Uber driver. A traffic infraction and then an accident with its self-driving cars. And a lawsuit over whether Uber's self-driving car team stole all their technology from Google. And that's all before you get to the whole crazy story about an escort karaoke bar in South Korea.
The Stylings of Mollywood, with whom I do a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Subscribe, listen, tell us what you think. Marketplace.org/makemesmart. When I hear, I thought we were going to be squeezed at the end. The Dow off 138 points today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ down 31 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 15.6%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for now. Anyways, John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.